And then he meets with a psychiatrist named Daryl Ray, who did this huge, massive study of people who have left their religion mm-hmm. and how much guilt they felt associated with their sexuality.
Yeah.
And it was about 30-something different denominations that they had on this histogram. And for the one that had the highest percentage of the amount of guilt that you felt when you rated, and they interviewed like something like 10,000 people who had left their religions.
Wow.
30 different religions or denominations or sects or whatever. And Mormons felt the highest percent of guilt associated with sex.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Faith Transition Podcast. In this episode, I interview my friend Dusty, a published herpetologist who grew up as a Mormon, a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Texas, graduated from BYU, and is currently completing his master's in the Dallas area. Dusty shares some of the issues he had with LDS doctrines starting in his science classes at BYU. He discusses a study of thousands of people across different faith traditions, showing Mormons coming on top for feelings of guilt related to sexuality. An avid student of Carl Sagan, Dusty shares how he transitioned from Mormonism to his current fact and science-based new sets of beliefs, with an open door for the unknown. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did having this discussion.
Tell me, you know, what's your relationship with the church, kind of your upbringing a little bit. We're not going to focus a lot on that, but just to have a background story of, you know, maybe tell me how you grew up in the church, how it was, you know, the pros and cons, all the way up to you going on a mission or BYU or, you know, meeting your ex-wife.
Yeah, so I was born into the church in Texas, down the Gulf Coast in Galveston County. My parents were converts. They converted in the mid-70s. I was born in 1980, and they had two older daughters that were about five and six or so. And then I was born in 1980. I was third. I was the first one to be born after my parents converted to the church. And they had missionaries knocked on their door. That's how they were introduced to it. My mom had also been checking out the Book of Mormon at the local library in Galveston County in the mid-70s or so. And so, yeah. I was the first one that was born in the covenant in 1980. And then after that, I had seven other siblings that were born after that.
All right. That's a pretty big family right there.
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely the biggest in my high school. There were some other Mormon families in our stake that were similar size, but they weren't like in our town.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So you grew up in the church, and how was that?
There were some good parts that I liked about it. I liked scouting and going camping because we had a really good scout master, and he would take us camping every month. It wasn't like a lot of other people's experiences with scouting. You know, I think a lot of people drop out because they don't have people, leaders who are as involved, and ours was very, very outdoorsy type person. He was also our bishop. So that part was fun. I also liked going to the dances. Enjoyed that, meeting other kids from other wards and stakes. You know, going to church, you know, you had camaraderie there. But then I was also the only Mormon in my graduating class, you know.
All right. And, yeah. That's different. So did people give you grief for that?
Or? They did. Yeah. You know, they would be like, you know, I mean, it started when I was in elementary school. Like, hey, Dusty, how many wives does your dad have, kind of thing, you know?
Wow. So like they're taught very young in Texas,
yeah,
I guess, about all
that stuff. It seems like I got a lot of flack from people in the Baptist church, from what I remember. Yeah, derivative of that same sect, you know, or religion.
But you dealt with it. You dealt with it okay.
It annoyed me, but I dealt with it okay, I guess. Yeah, I suppose I did. To a point, because I also, like, wanted to, you know, be connected with other kids in my class. And I felt like, in hindsight, I feel like it's something that kept me from feeling connected to other people. you know, I wouldn't party hard or anything like that when I was in high school. And right. That's what pretty much everybody, every kid in Texas does, you know, the backyard kegger parties and stuff. And so I do have some regrets about that part of my life.
Were you excited to go on a mission as expected, you know, from all active Mormon boys?
Yeah, I was. I don't know how, you know, high you would rate my level of righteousness or, you know, all of the yardsticks that we use, you know, yeah. that are superficial about measuring someone's awesomeness in the church or spirituality, et cetera. I was the type of teenager that listened to John, by the way, on cassettes right. and all that stuff.
I did too. I was deep into that and Hillary yeah. Dukes and Julie yeah. David, all the Mormon stars.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember too many of the other names, but
you did EFY and
I didn't do EFY, but I did some of the, what do you call it?
Like the youth camp.
Youth. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the youth camps and stuff that they would do like on a week or weekend or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we did a Nauvoo trip, a youth Nauvoo trip. That was like a week long. That was when I was 16.
Yeah. So we're going to go all the way to your, when you decide to go on a mission, like, were you super excited about it? Did you feel pressure to go? What was it?
I mean, I felt both. I felt excitement because I was, you know, a nerd who listened to John, by the way, or whatever on cassette, you know, I was into that whole spirituality and like feeling the spirit, you know, wanting to share it and go to Nauvoo and all that kind of stuff, right. you know, and I did feel like I had a quote unquote testimony of the church and I baptized when I was 18 or 19, 18, I guess, I baptized my girlfriend into the church. Wow. And there was another girl who we didn't date or anything like that, but we started out that way, kind of just talking kind of thing, kind of interested in each other and we just became friends. And then she got baptized into the church and I don't think she's active anymore. Actually, neither of those girls are active. Those women.
They got baptized for you, huh?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So in a way, I was already kind of a missionary. And so, yeah, I wasn't one of those ones who saved money for my mission or anything mm-hmm. like that. You know, my dad was pretty angry about that. I bought a guitar amplifier instead.
They had to pitch in every month.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I bought a guitar amplifier instead. And he was mad about that for years after my mission still. But I never regretted that. That was awesome.
All right. So then, so you go on a mission, and where did you go?
I went to Chile, Santiago East Mission. Yeah.
All right. How was that?
It was good. I mean, a lot of it was good. A lot of it was a struggle. And
what was good and what was the struggle?
Just being a different, entirely different part of the world, and seeing what people are like there. They're so warm and welcoming and friendly. You're like walking down the street. It doesn't matter that everybody already knows who the Mormons are in Santiago. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like you're coming up the lane and somebody's gonna be like, oh, answer to my prayers kind of thing. Yeah, right? Yeah, I mean, even though you hear those kind of stories on, you know, sacrament meeting on Sunday, but everybody already knows who you are because there's so many Mormon churches there, so many wards and stake centers and so forth. And there's a temple in Santiago. Yeah, I really love the people. It's interesting to get that different perspective. I think it's such an important part of your education is traveling and meeting other kinds of people, different walks of life. So that component is really awesome. Of course, meeting all the guys, meeting all the missionaries and making friends with them. And those are the highlights for me as far as like what I miss about it, you know.
Right.
As far as the negatives, I think in the mission I started to have some cognitive dissonance about myself, about various issues.
What caused it?
Well, when I first noticed it, I immediately noticed that there was a component of how cool you were, you know, among the missionaries and so forth, as far as like getting different, you know, leadership positions or recognition. There was a club that my second mission president started called the Pura Sangre, the thoroughbred.
Huh.
And you had to baptize a certain percentage of people every month. You had to teach a certain amount of discussions every week or whatever they call them now.
Right.
And so forth. And you had to baptize a family or whatever. And then like, and they would get like a special tea day, like every month kind of thing, you know? And it was like an all day thing. It was like in addition to.
Oh, wow. Maybe,
or I can't remember. So it was 20 years ago now almost when I went to the MTC, 1999. But it was definitely apart from, like, no, only the people in that group could go. And that was right around the time I started feeling all this cognitive dissonance about myself, and not necessarily doubts about the church, but just about the hierarchical structure.
Right, pitting the elders against each other, like making it a competition.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Because when I came into the mission, I felt like one of the cool guys, you know, I felt like one of the ones that everybody liked to be around and stuff like that. But as soon as that mission president left, who was actually a ancient scripture professor at BYU, my first mission president was. The second one was like a Arizona senator type. Actually, I think he was, or House of Representatives, something like that. And he's the one who came in with like all these, like, we were only, as a mission, I think we were only baptizing 35 people a month, the month that I arrived, you
that's
know.
That's actually pretty high compared to other, like, European mission, where it's probably one every 3 months or something, I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, go to Europe, dude.
So that was like my first
35
mission.
A month, that's huge.
Is it really?
Yeah,
well, that was like the lowest, like, because that was like my first mission president's trunky month, you know. Like, he's going home like that month, and so yeah, baptized like 35, and then the next mission president came in, it was like within 3 or 4 months we were doing like over 300 baptisms a month.
Oh my god. Was it like big pools kind of baptism where you have like 10 people at the same time, or
you would have most Sundays
300? That's crazy. I'm curious to know what's the retention level on these type of numbers.
Oh, it's nil. It's like so low. I mean, I saw that while I was there, you know.
They come get baptized because their friend is, and then the next
time. Yeah, it's a party.
Know what it's like. About.
It's a party. It's like.
Free food.
Yeah, it's like quinceañera or something. Not really, but 25% of, this is what the church says. When I went there, it was like something like 25% of Santiago is Mormon. You know?
Oh, wow. On paper.
And maybe even Google told me that. Yeah, you know, but yeah, on paper, exactly. Yeah, but ultimately those data come from the church, so yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty deceitful. Well, they did get in the water.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. 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 I mean, you could walk, it's like Utah, you could walk to chapels. I mean, you don't have to like have a car to get to a Mormon church.
All right. At every corner. That's interesting. So, yeah. All right. So the mission was okay. You had, you know, this cognitive dissonance, but you went home like still fully believing. You didn't have a traumatizing experience. Overall, it was pretty good.
Overall. But like, yeah, that cognitive dissonance kind of lasted the rest of that mission. That was like, that happened 6 months into my mission, you know?
So was it solely based on the practices of that mission president doing things that weren't really like Christ-like or like gospel-related?
Yeah.
It wasn't about the gospel itself or the you know, the church itself.
It wasn't about the doctrine itself. It was more about his actions. Like so the reason I didn't feel cool anymore is because I wasn't the one who was baptizing 3 to 6 people a month, you know, including whole families. I baptized one family during my whole mission, maybe two, you know. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't that big of a deal for the stats in our mission, you know.
Right.
But no, he actually brought us in. There was like early on, he brought us in one-on-one. We would have these, our zone conferences, and they would last all day, sometimes 2 days. And early on, he would bring us in and interview us like one by one, all 200 of us. And there was this one where he got down and he like cleaned our feet, basically washed our feet in one of these one-on-one interviews. And but with our shoes on. So like, it was like a shoe polish.
Oh yeah, that was pretty popular among mission president. I mean, you know, it's I think it's symbolic of Jesus washing his disciples' feet, and it makes you feel, you know, this super spiritual experience. I was pretty touched when my mission president did that to me. I don't know if it's appropriate.
No, for me, it was not a
there
good
were other
memory.
People in the room, so, and I actually really like him, but so I don't want to talk bad about it. But I think it was probably a thing among mission president because it was kind of a nice.
Well, yeah. That's cool that you thought it was actually positive for you. For me, it wasn't, because while he was doing it, he said something about me that like hurt me to my core.
What did he say?
He said, in Spanish, he said, I don't know why you don't want to do things well, Elder Rhodes.
Wow.
Like while he's doing this, he's like, he said, no sé por qué no quiero hacer las cosas bien, something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
and I'm just like, I understand Spanish. So like,
okay, yeah.
You not tying your shoe properly, or you not doing missionary work properly?
I guess missionary work. I wasn't baptizing enough, you know. I mean, I don't know, how do you measure that, you know? I don't know. Yeah. Like
that's terrible to put an accusation like that on someone. Like,
it crushed me. And it was like, and after that I felt like it just you're fighting so hard to defend that accusation that you become a self-fulfilling prophecy,
right?
Of that, you know. At least that's how I felt. You know,
like
I never
a failure of a missionary, which is terrible. But today you can be happy that there are two people you affected.
Right. Yeah.
See, we have the opposite. We're like, oh, I wish I could go back and tell them.
Right. Yeah. And I think most of the people that I quote unquote brought into the church, like, if not all of them, are like pretty much all inactive. There might be one or two.
That's a fair statistic.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that was a mission. So we can see, you know, a little bit of the questioning and doubting budding in there. And then what happened when you get home?
So when I get home, our mission president told us we had like a 3-day conference at his house, like the week before we went home. That might've been my first red flag about the church, was visiting the second mission president's home. It was so opulent. It was a mansion, you know. I mean,
what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that? Well,
not very Christ-like.
Well, because I was literally knocking on the doors of people who had
nothing.
A corrugated tin roof.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and a 5-gallon or 6-gallon bucket from basically like a Home Depot bucket for the toilet, you know.
You have to wonder, wouldn't a real Christian kind of maybe get a half the size house and then be so happy about giving to the poor needy of what they have, especially if they've been serving in their countries and know them better than others and
exactly.
love them so much, because how often do you hear that? Like, I love these people and
right, right. It's so cliche.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it was two thoughts. It was like, oh my gosh, these people here, like, they're giving money, they're giving everything, they're feeding us once a week. Like, you talk about people like who just give and give and give. They're not nothing like Americans. We're very like shut off. We don't just say hi to everybody who walks by on the street. And they would feed us, and it was always the poorest people who would feed us the most and most often, you know, and the best meals. Like, you got the best meals at the poorest residences and stuff.
That was my mom when she had nothing, because, you know, up and down she was struggling, but she was always feeding the missionaries. My whole family was mad at her. Why are you feeding this? And not just, you would feed like a whole
district. Because they're like, you're giving away our food.
Not just two. Like, she would feed a whole district. It's like almost.
Oh my gosh!
And my family was like, "What are you doing?" It's like, well, they're disciples of Jesus, you know. I have to feed them. Which I had a good time, you know, having dinner. Yeah. Like they were fun. And
do you feel like, I mean, this just came out of the goodness of your mom's heart, right? This is just how she was as a person.
Just a very, very giving person. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's why I feel like these people are good people, you know. But for my perspective now, I feel like their good nature is a little bit taken advantage of.
Because, you know, and I never felt like missionaries like taking advantage. I mean, they were just very, very, just, you know, young, cute, you know, happy go lucky, like
try
to do the best they can. And I have friends to this day, like I'm friends with some of these missionaries to this day, whether, you know, regardless that I'm out, but
shiny, happy people.
Yeah, yeah, right. Who doesn't want to be around that? You
right.
know,
yeah.
especially
yeah.
when everything is grim around. Like you want that.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think, you know, they do good. They do well. They well intentioned, but yeah, of course, it's all calculated, and that's where I think sometimes goes wrong. But
yeah.
But I think, you know, having been with missionaries a lot, like even as a youth, because I was so zealous, like I was out, I was knocking on doors, I was just with them before even my mission. Like, I think there was an honest, genuine friendship going on and camaraderie and, you know, and they got a respite from the outside world that was really harsh to them too, especially in Europe where most people couldn't, you know, they don't care whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so being able to come to the members and have that little bit of, you know, respite and breathing and feeling, being comfortable and not pressured to like go and convert someone. I think I'm glad we were able to do that because it's a tough world out there for missionaries.
Yeah. 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 No doubt. Yeah.
So there was a discrepancy between like that opulence from your mission president and then.
And I also thought about my parents, like my dad. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. You know, I'm a third of 10 kids, so she had 8 of us at one time under the roof, you know, or actually 9 of us, you know. And it was a small house at first, you know, until my dad got a better job whenever I was 13. You know? So it was thinking about my dad is slaving away, and we live in a house that's smaller than us, and we're 10 kids, you know.
Well, some people might say, that was a choice. To have that many kids, why?
No, it definitely was, you know. But I think, I'll just say in general, I don't know where this whole, I have different philosophies on where this whole idea about having so many kids, you know, comes from, and like the push to have a big family and right away when to get married. And but I know it was one of the presidents, President Snow, he made a comment, something like, you know, my wife has mothered 11 children and she would not basically have her exaltation if she had not done so. That's exactly what he said.
You think your dad read that and took it to heart?
I do. And I've already told him this. So it's not like if he hears this, if he ever does, I don't think he would. But I mean, he doesn't seek out this kind of media, you know. But I've already told him this. And I asked him, like, why did you have, you know, 10 kids? And he's like, I don't know.
This happened. This happened.
Yeah.
We don't believe in
protection. Like, I don't know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, so at that point you're annoyed with, you know, assessing the situation and seeing what's going on and like you're like, "Ugh, this doesn't sit right with you." Looking at your mission president and then your mission kind of looking at, you know,
that was the first thing that didn't sit right. Yeah. But it was one of those things that you table it as a someone who wants to just believe.
Right.
You table it. And so that's what I did. But I never forgot it. It wasn't until I had already got back from the mission and which was what we were about to talk about, right? But that I started and got married and went to BYU that I started having like serious doubts.
So you first got married or you first went to BYU?
First got married. So yeah, when I got back from a mission in Texas from Chile, I went to the like the young single adult stuff and the Institute of Religion, which was on a college campus down in Galveston County. And there were, in the height of the, you know, the busy season, which is the summer, there were 100 of us there. And that's where we had our, you know, YSA activities and Wednesday night.
Young single adults, for those who are not from the Mormon church.
Yeah, YSA, yeah, young single adults. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, young single adults. And so that's from age 18 to 30, I think, that you would have there with the church education system, CES. And so we had a Institute of Religion. We had an institute teacher. He was great, you know, definitely like one of those really funny, like, I mean, the church hired him from Utah, you know, to come down and do this full time. So
that was high caliber.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he was from Utah. He was definitely Intermountain West. You know.
The real stuff.
Yeah. Funny, you know, everybody loved him. He was buff, he worked out, you know, just like Mr. Clean up there, you know.
Someone to look up to.
Yeah. And that's where I met my ex-wife, now ex-wife. Yeah.
So I'm always curious. I'm always curious to know, how long did you date and how long did it take for you to get married?
We met in August of 2002. I proposed for like the third time when she said yes or something like that. I proposed at least twice, but I did it the second
time. She would say no each time, or what?
It was because like the first time I was just kind of like super like swept away in the moment, like kind of marry me kind of thing without even planning it out, you know? And like, and she was just like, ask me some other time kind of thing, you know? It wasn't a no, it wasn't a yes.
I need a better ask.
Yeah. Yeah, so the yes came in front of the Houston LDS Temple on Valentine's Day, 2003.
Okay, so that's decent timing there.
Yeah, so 6 months maybe from dating to asking.
And then when was the marriage?
July 5th, 2003.
So just about a year, all in all.
All in all, under a year, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
That's so yeah, I was only 22 when I got engaged. You know, I mean, I was almost 22 when I got back on my mission, so.
Right, yeah. Craziness.
Yeah, I worked at a veterinary clinic for, actually two veterinary clinics.
You went to, I'm going to say this wrong, you went to entomology?
Yeah, that's insects and bugs and stuff. I'm in herpetology.
Okay. So
herpeton means like creeping, crawling thing.
Like the lizard?
In Latin. Like lizards and turtles and stuff, because they all have legs that, like, all mammals have legs that are directly underneath their body, you know, like straight.
Right.
So we have, you know, all mammals have legs that go straight down. Birds do too, pretty much. But reptiles, like, their legs are shaped like that, you know, right. So they can waddle around. And ones that have lost their legs over time, AKA snakes and, you know, some legless lizards, they can kind of wiggle through the grass, you know.
Which reminds me, I have to show you a picture of something I found on my run, and it looks like a snake that may have legs. I don't know.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Yeah. We do have some in the DFW area that look like that, and they're called skinks.
Yeah. A friend of mine on Facebook, I put a picture and he's like, I think that's a skink. So I'm like, oh, I didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
I have to Google it. So anyway, you went into that and you love it. You're passionate about it.
Always loved it ever since I was a little kid. I don't ever remember not loving reptiles, snakes, lizards, catching them, taking them to show and tell when I was 5, you know, in kindergarten. And ever since then, really, took them to high school, even, you know, the biology classes. It was one of those things, like, you didn't have, like, after I got into middle school, you had to, like, tell me to do my homework. I wasn't a very, like, good student.
Mm-hmm.
As far as scholastics and stuff was concerned. But you didn't have to tell me to go out and check out books about snakes and lizards and stuff at the library. I did that ever since I was a little kid. Yeah.
I mean, it's really cool to find your passion so early and then stick to it. I think that's pretty admirable. A lot of people just are still trying to figure out what they're passionate about.
Yeah, I'm really lucky about that. Yeah. It's taken me places. I've always wanted to write a book about snakes because I was the snake guy, you know. I was the kid that knew snakes and brought snakes to show and tell, and I got magazines, you know, about herpetologists, and I saw these cool people going to different places like Peru and Australia and seeing all these cool animals and then writing about it, and I was like, man, that's what I want to do. And so I wrote one of the authors of the books that I had about corn snakes in the early 90s when I was like 10 or 11, and he wrote me back, and we still didn't have a computer at the time in my family. So he was like, well, you know, I told him I wanted to write a book, you know, what is some advice you have for, you know, an author of 12, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And the next decade I wrote a book, you know, I was 25, 26, 27, something like that, and wrote a book about snakes. And so, yeah, it's always been there. It's always something I've wanted to be involved with. And after I published my book, people started, you know, knowing who I was, you know, as far as people in the snake hobby, snake sciences and so forth. And so I still get flown out to go speak at places about different aspects of snakes or herpetology or lizards or conservation.
And
you know, it's not hard to become an expert, because snakes alone, there's 3,200 different kinds of snakes, you know.
But you could even pick a few and become really good at what you know about them.
Yeah, because a lot of them, it's like there's hardly anything published about them, you know, and right. So you can pick one. And that's what I did. I picked one that's here in Texas called the Trans-Pecos rat snake, which you find out in the Big Bend National Park area. And basically, I just consolidated everything that was known about this animal into one place, you know, and then did a lot of my own research and stuff and put that in there too.
And I'll have to look up your book.
Yeah, it's funny. I always talk about this because there was a funny statistic in one of the newspapers at BYU while I was there, and it was, there are 93 miles of bookshelves in the Harold B. Lee Library. Maybe it was 98 miles. It was almost 100. And it's like, I always thought about, like, what proportion of those books, how many miles of those books are all about one species, humans, and yet how much do we still not know about humans, you know? And this was the first book about, of any sort, about this species of snake, you know, and there's just so much that we don't know about the critters that are right here, literally in our backyard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's good that people like you dig into it and, you know, bring in new knowledge, and, you know, because we always need new knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. I do too. I mean, I did this book because I wanted to read a book about them. I did the book that I wanted to read, you know?
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was like, I want to read a book about these snakes. Well, there isn't one. Well, okay. I guess I'll start putting a website together. And I was like, well, I've always wanted to write a book. So I did. And I got lucky because it got published in 2008, right before the economy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so I didn't have to pay, I didn't have to self-publish or anything like that. The publisher, I sent him a brief synopsis of the book, a sample chapter, and he called me the next day and said, yes, we want to publish it, you know.
Cool.
And so I didn't have to, you know, put any of the cost for publishing. And it's in hardback with, you know, a dust jacket. It's really nice. They only did about 3,300 copies, you know, but it's one out of 100 different kinds of snakes in Texas, so it's a pretty niche market.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, because I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's called the Complete Sub-Oc. It's called the Complete Sub-Oc. And
no, I'll go and buy it just to support you. I know you're a student, so.
I have 3 boxes in my closet, just FYI.
Okay. All right, well, let's get back on track here. And so you get married, and then you have a couple of kids, if I understand.
I have one, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I get married in 2003. We don't have a kid right off. We actually don't have a kid for 6 years.
Okay.
But we have some very typical stories of the kind of thing, you know, interactions you get with members.
Right.
You know, when you're not
have
kids
right
off.
When is it coming?
Yeah.
Business.
the craziest one was at Temple Square. It was at the mission you were in. Were you in Temple Square? Yes. So the craziest interaction we had was with a sister missionary at Temple Square about that topic.
What year was that? It wasn't when I was there, because you went. I'm older than you. So
yeah. It was 2005. Yeah.
Way after my mission. But so what happened?
Well, we went on a date from Provo to Salt Lake to Temple Square at, it was around Christmas time, because the Christmas lights and stuff were out. And we went up to the Christus, the statue. And the sister missionary, who was like the docent there, was just asking us about us. We'd only been married 2 years. We got married 2003. We had kids. And she's like, where's the kids? And we're like, she's very blunt, you know?
Yeah.
We're like,
where was she from? She was really a foreigner.
No, she was American. Yeah.
Okay. That's surprising, because I wouldn't be surprised if it was a foreigner, because, you know, we foreigners are very weird and direct.
Yeah, really? Yeah. I guess it was like that in Chile too. Yeah, they were very direct in my mission. Yeah. She asked us that, and we're like, well, you know, not yet. She was like, oh, she was like, well, all of my siblings are married and all of them had kids within like the first year, you know?
It's pretty common. It's pretty common.
And, you know, we're just kind of like, well, go your sisters, you know, or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Thanks, sister. That was very uplifting.
Right.
Message right there.
Yeah.
So you waited a few years and then you had your son.
Yep. So he came along when I was still at BYU. It took me a few years to graduate. I didn't graduate till 2009. I started a business breeding and selling snakes and then writing my book and just kind of dropped all my classes that semester when they said, yeah, we want to publish. I was like, okay.
That's pretty entrepreneurial though.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it was something I always wanted to do. So it was no way I was going to like just not take the opportunity. But finished in December 2009, and that's when my son was born, was December 2009. Yeah, that was a really harrowing time because she actually went into labor during finals week.
And
you know, at BYU, like, people are having babies right and left, and so you can't say like, so at least one of my professors, we had a lab practical. It's 3 hours long, and she went into labor like when I had to go in there and do this. And
it
was like,
oh no!
Yeah, like with dead cow parts and stuff everywhere, you know. And I'm like, my wife is having a baby. Like she's hatched. They already gave her the epidural.
Were you able to leave?
Not for the first hour and a half. She's like, you have to finish this test. She's like, it took me hours and hours and hours to set out all these cow organs and stuff, you know, all over the table and stuff, you know, so you have to.
That is so rude.
Yeah.
Like, how often, you know, a baby comes to the world and, you know, right. It's not like you're going to, like, these cows, like, you can put them back or whatever.
Yeah. Because it was like the last day right before Christmas break, you know, so which is a month long, you know, and maybe it's less than that at BYU. I don't think they allow month long breaks at BYU. I'm trying to remember, but
I bet you were like stressed to the rim. Like, I know what it's like. Well, my ex also was in exam time when, you know, we were having baby number two, and I remember the stress he endured, which was not fun. And I felt, I mean, I'm like, I don't, you know, what do you do? They come.
Yep.
But yes, I can't imagine the stress though.
I got to see him being born, but it was really late, you know? It was like really late at night before I even got over there. And she went into labor like early in the day. We didn't even know what it was. I didn't know that she was in labor, you know? My neighbor called me saying, Dusty, this is happening, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
She was trembling and stuff.
Well, I'm glad you didn't miss it. That's good.
I still feel bad to this day sometimes when I think about it. Like, gosh, we were so ignorant, like, you know?
Yeah. You were there, so you didn't miss that. And then, okay, so then how do things progress to the point where, you know, what led to, you know, your divorce and you questioning?
Yeah, I was in a program at BYU that at most places is called ecology and evolutionary biology, or evolutionary biology and ecology, vice versa, EEB major, you know. It was called integrative biology at BYU, and I was one of only 10, and there were like more than 300 regular biology majors, so it was like kind of more evolution focused. If you're a biology major at BYU, at least back then, I'm sure it's the same way still, they overcorrected so hard about evolution. Because it's evolution is the capstone course that you're required to take as a biology major at BYU. The first two or three lectures are actually about the history of evolution in the church and how they weren't always, you know, simpatico.
Right.
And they talked about, you know, what intelligent design is, what creationism is, all this stuff. And actually all of the evolution that I've been around since then, and I've seen two other university campuses teach it, none of them were as emphatic about all that stuff. And I think it was great. We had really great evolution professors at BYU, multi-million dollar labs, genomicists, geneticists that all do evolutionary biology type work. Even on human stuff. In fact, one of the most famous evolutionary biologists and geneticists, Daniel Fisher, is used to be a dean of undergraduate students or something like that at BYU, and now he's the dean of sciences at UVU in also in the Provo Orem area, right? So really amazing science professor. He does clay sculptures of Darwin, like of their bust, you know, and Gregor Mendel. He's a world-renowned scholar on Gregor Mendel and, you know, the history of that and everything with genetics. Right. He's a grandson and a son of some of the major sculptors on Temple Square for some of the sculptures.
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Which makes you wonder, so that one professor who went to UVU, like, what do you think, like, how did they reconcile, like, you know, being a Mormon, believing in, you know, God creation
and then
believe in the science, the hard science of, you know.
That is a question I still struggle with. Like, I still think about that on an almost daily basis, because I still have friends, like, not very many, but friends who were professors and my advisors and so forth at BYU. Mm-hmm. And who were my boss, you know, I was a TA and a tutor for the evolution class after I took it, because I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much about it that I realized, well, wait a second, why did God take 150 years to change his mind on this issue? My advisor at BYU was the first evolutionary biologist that BYU ever hired. Mm-hmm. And he was hired in 1982. He's also a herpetologist. He was actually the reason I really wanted to go to BYU and study herpetology, because I knew that they taught it there. They have a really great life science museum there, as you know, with really amazing collections of plants and beetles, especially, and also herps is what we call them, reptiles and amphibians, thousands and thousands of them. But he was the first one. He was the first one that they hired, you know, and he was hired after I was born in the early 80s. And he just retired last year. I saw him at a Biology of the Lizards conference last summer. Mm-hmm. Southern New Mexico in the Chiricahua Mountains. But
did you have ever want to have that conversation with him about, you know, how does he reconcile teaching?
I would like to have the conversation. So he was actually one of the first, I don't know if he was one of the first, but one of the few non-Mormon professors at BYU, my advisor there. But I had others who I'm still friends with in that same program, who are amazing guys. You know, and they have PhDs. They have more education than I do, for sure, and like way more publications and stuff. I'm barely getting started. I'm just in graduate school, you know. But I still wonder. I would still like to have that conversation with those people, yeah, with those friends.
Right. Yeah. I have my theory with, you know, highly informed, knowledgeable. Like, I do think there is a division that's made in the brain because of the way you were brought up. And ultimately, admitting that you're wrong on something that's so fundamental, you know,
when
you're super smart and you can be so wrong on something so fundamental. I know the hurt. I felt it. But, you know, admitting that you were wrong, I think some people would over their dead body, you know, like, because it's just too much, especially when you have built a life on it.
Right.
You know, it's very difficult. And I get it. I think everyone should read Catherine Schultz Being Wrong, because it would make them
really
better. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
I'll talk about it in episode 2 of the podcast, but Being Wrong.
I was looking for my phone so I could find it on Audible.
I'll send it to you. Yeah. Adventures in the Margin of Error. It just puts you at ease with being wrong, and just, it's just a human thing, and accepting it, even as bad as it can be, except for, of course, you know, genocide and world wars and stuff like that. But like, humanly, just get comfortable with that, people. I say,
That's so good.
I mean, often, anyways.
You know, that's a big part of the spirit of science, you know. And the reason I fell in love with evolution when I was at BYU is because it was like, oh, I can make predictions about. It made me understand what science was. That it was basically like I could take things that random facts that I already knew about lizards and snakes, and make predictions about what we should see, based on this conceptual framework, this theory, you know.
And you can be right and you can be wrong.
Yeah. And I could actually test hypotheses, because like, I always knew I wanted to be a biologist, but I thought that meant just like, oh, let's go look in the stomachs of a bunch of snakes of your favorite snake species and see what they ate kind of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's not really science. That's just observation, you know? Right. And so this was what made me like, okay, the world is knowable and you can make predictions about it. And these are exactly what we do see, you know? When one of the predictions of evolution, for instance, is that you shouldn't see very many species of, like, say, mammals or terrestrial animals that can't get to an archipelago, like a group of islands or something, without having swam there or flown there, you know. And you don't see that kind of stuff. You see things that floated there, you know, like in Galapagos Islands and stuff, you know. Yeah. And reptiles, since they're cold-blooded, their metabolism is a lot slower, and so they can go a lot longer without food. And so if you're in a hurricane and you get washed out as flotsam, you know, out into the ocean, right, and you find a group of branches that got washed out as well that you can cling to, you might just by chance end up on an island somewhere. And so that's a prediction.
It's fascinating, right?
Yeah, and that's a prediction that it makes. And so you can see that that's exactly what the prediction is, you know, that it fulfills that prediction. Yeah. And so that's what made it so exciting for me. And so that's sort of where my love of science came from, I guess you could say, and my passion for that. That happened in 2009, which happened to be this, it was a big hullabaloo about Darwin that year because it was the 200th anniversary of his birth,
right,
and the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species, his most famous
book. I think I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
and BYU, they flew in all these like really amazing award-winning speakers, you know, who are evolutionary biologists and paleontologists and so forth. And it was like all these happenings of evolution going on, and which is funny because all of the statements that come the first presidency of the church and other members of the Quorum of the 12 and so forth, most of the ones that have ended up in the media or you know, first presidency type, you know, announcements and so forth, have all come during years when it was like something big in evolution was going on, like the Scopes monkey trials in 1925, you know, in Tennessee. And 1909, which was the 100th anniversary, there were some big statements from the church about evolution then, which were mostly anti, you know.
Wow. It's interesting when you start putting these things side to side. And, I mean, you think of the Eyrings, right? They were also, like, big scientists in the church. And you have to wonder, like, I don't know. I have my own theories. But, again, it boils down to pride and not admitting.
You think so?
Well, enough because it's too much. I mean, it's a legacy.
Yeah, it's job security too. You know,
absolutely.
It's like you're working towards your.
Yeah, it's like what do I do after I'm an apostle? Like, what's my next job? You know.
Yeah.
although these people are super smart, like they probably could land. You know, but I mean, it just carries too much, like generational from the earlier time, your legacy. Your ancestry. I mean, it takes enormous amount of courage and, you know,
I had way less to risk by denying it all, so to speak.
Yeah, you don't.
But I still, like, it wrecked my life, you know? I mean, it completely knocked me out of orbit.
Imagine when you have so much more. And also because all these people have, I mean, in today's language, they have a following, not just the church itself, but like individually.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
You know, I had my favorites. Like I was like, you know, Shieka Okazaki, Sheridu. You know, he.
Oh, yeah.
I had my, you know, Uchtdorf, big time. I had my favorites. They have a following, and guaranteed. Yeah. I mean, when you see even bishops when they leave the church, I mean, there is a bunch of people following. I mean, who get faith crisis or whatever, or like a stake president. If you have a little bit of a status in the church, guaranteed you're going to affect other people. So if you're on the worldwide scene, I mean, there's no way. And that's probably why they do like the super secret handshake of like never falling away, no matter what, you know.
Right.
True. This is not, I'm not making this up. It's true. They have their very secret handshakes at the temple, like do
like that are not that are beyond the level that you and I have seen.
Oh yeah, like nobody knows.
are these Masonic as well?
Oh, who knows? But it's a blood oath, pretty much. Like you gotta give your life because you couldn't get to these positions unless you gave an oath never to, you know, turn around, because
so it's like the mafia.
Yeah, pretty much. So
like the mafia. There's no going against
and
the family.
Don't believe me. Just do your research and you'll find out. Like I don't care if I have to prove my point here. there is a reason why I'm not in anymore.
right. Yeah.
Many reasons. Yeah. But anyways, so again, this is not about bashing the church. I want to know about
sure. No, and I'm not. Yeah.
And it just makes me laugh. But
I was thinking about favorites. Camille Franck Olson. Did you remember her? Camille Franck Olson. She was one of the Book of Mormon professors at BYU. But she was also on the television, you know, programs that they would have on Sunday mornings and stuff on BYU channel.
I don't know.
Scripture readings.
It's probably after my time. Like you,
I had such a crush on her, and she was so sweet to me. She's like, when my book came out, she sent me this like beautiful, like, you know, calligraphy handwritten letter and stuff, because they published a little thing about me in the BYU newspaper.
Oh yeah,
cool.
So,
oh,
cool.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I'm not like deep into like, you know, Mormon celebrities. Like I'm like the really top ones, like the ones below. I'm not sure where they are, but so anyway, so how do you come then? You said divorce came first or faith crisis came first?
Faith crisis came first. So before, evolution was kind of the second, not the second thing, but it was probably third or fourth thing that, you know, and so like, I noticed that there were a bunch of creationists in our ward, for instance, you know, who would get up and they would bear their testimony about how, you know, they know that we didn't come from no monkeys kind of thing, you know? and so there was a cognitive dissonance there too. I felt like I didn't belong, because I was excited about science. I was excited about the knowledge that you could get about the universe and about our evolutionary history from science. I felt like that excitement didn't even exist with anyone at church, you know, and they just knew that it was this and it wasn't that, you know.
You'd think that people with so many kids wouldn't doubt the fact that we come from monkeys, right?
Right.
You look at children, you're like, what?
Right. Some of them are even born with tails. You know? But yeah. So let's get back to your question. So your question was,
so how did you like hit like the actual faith crisis where you decide to reject everything?
Yeah. So that was just all the cognitive dissonance. But it was in 2007 is when that PBS documentary came out, or maybe it might have been Nova or something, but it was on PBS called The Mormons.
Yeah.
And it caused a big stir, you know, because there was all this, Mormons would call it anti-Mormon stuff in it. But it was just history.
It's just facts.
Yeah, it was just history. And it was stuff.
It's not anti, it's just facts.
And there was so much true stuff in there that even some, like, I think it was Marlon K. Jensen or whoever the historian was at the time, said, yeah, this basically happened kind of thing. And it's like, why was I never taught that? And it's not that, and I always felt like incensed about it, because not because I couldn't handle that, you know, because you always get like the gaslighting thing from a lot of still true believing Mormons, you know, where they say like,
you should have known.
You should have known, you know, I always knew about that, you know, or whatever.
You didn't do your homework.
Like, yeah. It's like, I did all of the steps, you know, I went to seminary, early right. morning seminary, you know, and like,
yeah.
5 or 5:30 a.m. or whatever it was, and I've never been an early morning person. I'm nearly 40 years old, you know.
You made and the sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
Get the true knowledge.
Yeah, and I didn't graduate from seminary because I was so kicking and screaming about going. But I went all 4 years, and I went more consistently than not. You know, at least the first 3 years. You know. But, and then I did that, and then I baptized my girlfriends for crying out loud, you know, and I went on a mission, and I went to BYU, and I did all the steps, and it's like, I was at BYU when I'm learning this shit, you know, it's like, I don't know if I can cuss through, you know.
Yep, but you can. Okay. We're all adults here. Listen.
All right, cool. But, yeah, it's like, I was already at BYU when I was learning this, and I was already married in the temple, you know, for like 2 years already, and I did all the steps, you know, and I gave years of my life to this.
Well, and how many hours at church, like when you compute everything, you know, it's like, dude, we spend more time than most just every Sunday going to church and sitting throughout all these classes and stuff, like, and you can't seep it through, you know, the lesson somehow, like we have to discover it all in like some bulk outside of church.
And it's one of those things that pains me, is because it's like, I would love to spend more time with my parents and family and stuff. And it's usually like, well, not usually, but often they don't stay a whole weekend. They just come up for like a few hours on a Saturday, and because they live about 4 hours away from me, mm-hmm. and at least four, it's usually not the whole week because they have to get back because they have to teach, you know, or they have a talk
right
in church the next day, and they have to go visit, teach, or whatever they call it now, mm-hmm. ministering.
I don't remember. Busy work.
Yeah. But it's Mormon stuff, you know, it's church stuff. Mm-hmm. And that takes precedence over family. Yeah. I don't care if it's church on Sunday, it's still precedence over family if you have to get back from Dallas to Fort Worth.
They only have 2 hours now.
Yeah, so, yeah. Which was, that's what it was when, right before I was born, I think. They changed it, I think, in 1980 to 3 hours in Texas, or maybe everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always known the 3 hours. And
yeah.
We were hoping and waiting for the day, but that day came after I was out.
Yeah.
So back to the faith crisis.
Yeah, saw the Mormons on PBS, and there was so much stuff I didn't know on there. And then I went on a trip with an ornithology class. That's birds science. And we went on a field trip to Southern Utah. And I think on the way back, we stopped at the Mountain Meadows Massacre Monument. That's a lot of M's. We stopped there, and I had no idea. I had no idea. And here we are stopping at this place, you know, and it's like, what? It's a monument.
Like you had never heard of it?
I had never heard of it.
Because I've heard of it growing up, but it was kind of always kind of washed, like it wasn't a big deal, or, you know, like hush, hush kind of thing.
And that was another, like, at least orange flag, if not red flag, of, it just seemed like
feeling a little dumb that you didn't know.
Yeah, and feeling dumb that I didn't know. Like, oh, you're one of those, you know. That's why you were only in the Pura Sangre, you know, on your mission for 1 month. You know? So, yeah.
I mean, you know how
I'm still embarrassed about it. It's like,
you can link everything. You can link, you know how in the church you can link everything. Oh, that's why.
Yeah.
You're so unrighteous.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. They can pin that on me. Yeah.
That explains it all. Anyways, it's really not laughing, no laughing matter, because that is just super shocking when you learn about that.
Yeah. And here's the thing. My attitude this whole time has been, I can handle dirty laundry, honestly, about mm-hmm. our organization, any organization. Every person has it. Every organization has it. But don't hide it and act like it doesn't exist, especially, which is bad in of itself. Mm. But you especially don't hide it and act like it doesn't exist if you're the one true church.
Yes.
And I thought the truth, no matter what, matters.
Yeah, that's when it goes.
That's what I thought. And it doesn't matter. Only certain truths. It's cherry-picked.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's not me bashing the church.
If it's going to hurt the image. But you know what's interesting? Yeah. I don't know if you remember on the mission, but they always said, you know, don't talk about past transgression and da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, in hindsight, it's because you guys have so much past transgression. That's why you don't like to talk about it as an institution. You know what I mean? Do you remember, did your mission person ever say that? Don't talk to people you teach about your past transgression.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Don't talk about that. I'm like, when you think about it, that's the best way to actually relate to people, is to talk about stuff you've been through and how you overcame it, because that's human. It's human. But they're like, don't talk about, like, just pretend to be all perfect, you know? Because that's what the church does. That's really, really deep down what they do, is pretend to be perfect when you've got a whole load of crap going on, you know?
Yeah. Somebody once called it like fractal recursivity, and I don't know if that's the right
thing. I don't even know that term, but
it's just like, it's kind of like a pattern that you see like on the seashell, you know, it has like little rings that go in a spiral, you know? Yeah. And then you crack open the seashell and there's still a spiral going inside. Mm-hmm. And so, and then like you look at it microscopically and there's still spirals. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like what's done at the top of the church trickles down behaviorally through the rest of the members.
Absolutely. 100%. All right. So at that point you see that PBS show and you're like, okay. And then you start digging. Did you start researching things, or what was your process?
It was definitely, I didn't dig a whole lot, but I encountered things. I encountered people who were in, you know, social media, like YouTubers, and who were skeptical of Mormonism at the very least, if not very, you know, make fun of it and so forth, who were right? You know, and so, yeah, I think that was what opened up the floodgates, opened up the doors, that PBS documentary.
What year was it again?
The PBS, the documentary came out in 2007.
Oh, so that's a while ago for you.
Yeah. And like I said, didn't start taking evolution until 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So it had already kind of set the wheels in motion.
So how long did it take for you from that moment to completely disconnect?
It took me from that moment till 2012.
Okay.
2011.
So you pretty much active, like regular, you have your questions, but you active and you still do things, you know, like you always, you've always.
Yep. Went to church. We went to a, when we were at Ole Miss for graduate school the first time, we went to a, you know, a BYU fireside when BYU came down to play Ole Miss, mm-hmm. you know, so we still went to like all the stuff. We did the Mormon stuff.
Did you go to temple as well? Or?
I did go to the temple some, but I actually struggled with some worthiness issues. Like, mm-hmm. or at least I thought I did. And that's the thing. It was my own perception is that I was unworthy for most of my marriage from 2003 to 2012.
You're not alone. Just know that you're not alone.
Yeah. After 2005, I never went to the temple. I never went to any of the temples in Utah after we moved from Texas to BYU.
Because you felt unworthy yourself.
Because I felt unworthy. Yeah. I was convinced, you know, I would basically self-castigate. You know, I was basically convinced that I was a transgressor.
You know? Without going into, you know, personal things, I don't want to make you uncomfortable or whatever, but is it because you were doing things that you thought were wrong, but in reality aren't?
I was doing things that the church said was wrong
mm-hmm.
from certain venues,
right?
So to speak.
I think all adults can imagine what they yeah. are. We don't want to
right. We can't. I don't around. Care. We can talk about it. You know, it doesn't, you know, but it's like in practice, nobody was really following, you know, and the ones who felt bad about it were the ones who are going to like the BYU, like group therapy, you know, and even a lot of those didn't really feel that bad about it. You know, I was
just to be clear, because it is, I think, important, like masturbation porn, stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's widespread. I mean, in the world, it's like a non-issue.
It's a non-issue. It's a non-issue in the world.
So
every animal also does it, you know,
I think it's worse with guys in the church, I guess, because guys maybe do it more. I don't know. But just about every guy. My ex, I don't know, feels like huge amount of guilt. Like,
oh my God.
Like, it's
oh my God.
Weird.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, it,
debilitating amount of guilt that carries on to the marriage.
Completely. So much overwhelming guilt, a debilitating guilt. You are absolutely right. You know, you know who Richard Dawkins is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Famous professor, scientist from Great Britain, evolutionary biologist. He did a book called The God Delusion.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar with that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the BBC, I think it was the BBC, did a 2 or 3 part documentary series based on that book. And he goes and he visits an anti-masturbation Christian camp in the US, you know, and it's just amazing the kind of culture that is. And
I've never even heard of that.
Oh my gosh.
I've heard about, you know, like places to help homosexual like change and, you know, which is completely bunker and crazy, but like I haven't even heard of like a masturbation like.
Yeah, and it's just it's all men pretty much who go to these things.
Wow.
And it's just horrible. You know, of course, and they have their anti-masturbation camp celebrities who they do this for a living, and they travel around and
oh my God.
Go from place to place, you know, from city to city, and have these people who come and
so sick.
Yeah, I think the one in the that Richard Dawkins talks about in the book or the documentary series was called Every Man's Choice or something like that. And so they have that, and then he meets with a psychiatrist named Daryl Ray, who did this huge, massive study of people who have left their religion. mm-hmm. and how much guilt they felt associated with their sexuality.
Yeah.
And it was about 30 something different denominations that they had on this, mm-hmm. on this histogram. And for the one that had the highest percentage of the amount of guilt that you felt when you rated, and they interviewed like something like 10,000 people who had left their religions.
Wow.
30 different religions or denominations or sects or whatever. And Mormons felt the highest percent of guilt associated with sex.
I'm not even surprised.
I'm not either. That's why it's like, these are like, yeah, this is where this all comes
everything
from.
Everything shows when I did write an op-ed on that, just like the kind of twisted, you know, sexual messaging that we get from the moment we're young.
Yeah.
And we're not alone. I mean, I'm only talking about the faith I come from because that's what I know. I absolutely know that it's not, you know, unique to Mormons, but the simple fact that, you know, in that study of tens of thousands of people, we come up top is really disturbing because it means that really something's got to change and quickly. I'm glad you mentioned that because I wasn't even aware of that. And I wrote an op-ed on like, just from my observation, like things are quick and twisted and they've got to, you know. But yeah, I think that's a very important message to put out there because I know, you know, from, you know, some of the conversations we've had, you know, off, you know, personally, that's something you suffered from. I know many, many guys who are still suffering and have suffered from this kind of messaging. And you know that not much is changing.
Yeah, that's basically why my marriage ended.
My thing is, I do still, for some reason, care about people who are blinded and are suffering because actually I talk to a lot. Many have written to me, and that's why I open my mouth because many don't dare to because there's just too much at stake. So I'm like, look into it because I'm not afraid to say it. Disturbing, like you need to change your messaging on so many levels because you're screwing up people big time and marriages. Why so much porn? Why so much, you know, unsatisfaction? Because people are so repressed and don't know how to express their sexuality. They don't know how to talk about it. They feel guilty about it. It's just so messed up. Like, just have a class on Sunday to teach people how to open up because that would be useful. And that
totally. That would be so useful.
One problem.
Yeah.
Actually talked about it. Helped, you know.
They should reconsecrate all the temples to that. You know,
have a room about how to, you know, express your sexuality because it's normal, it's human. We all do it, whether you lie about it or you don't, we all do it. So,
right, yeah, totally.
Yeah, but that was one of the major reasons which leads to, you know, your divorce.
Yep.
You know, probably a spouse being outraged or whatever about something, and then you're like,
and she was the only person I had ever had sex with. You know, I'd fooled around, you know, with some people I dated and stuff in high school, because you know, you have those urges; those are natural.
Right.
And there's even a lot of, I mean, this came out. We'll talk about this later. We'll come back to this, but there's a lot of research that came out before I was even born, basically, that you suppress people sexually, their nations tend to be more violent.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, look around, like Taliban and all that. Then people who want to, or if not, you know, physically violent, there is an emotional repression as well. You look at the FLDS and how controlled they are in who they can be with and how and when.
Yeah.
And it's messed up, you know, and there is some level of that in definitely the mainstream. Absolutely. Yeah. See, I haven't even done the studies you've done. To me, I just have to look around and be like,
And that's what I find so empowering about this faith transition is I have come to so many bits and pieces of knowledge of truth and of historical, scientific, whatever, that I independently discovered, you know, or thought about. And pretty much everybody else is thinking about it too. So that's how you know something, you're onto something.
Absolutely. Like someone was like,
corroboration.
Beating on me on Facebook on some silly thing, saying, oh, you're just disputing, you know, you're just repeating what you've heard. I'm like, no, because I don't care about that. I've done my own research and came to my own conclusion. Because believe it or not, it's much harder to figure out that you were wrong and admit it than just kind of go along with, you know, what would be the joy of like repeating some, you know, that's what you do by like dumping the Bible on me. Like how long has that been repeated over and over? Like instead of giving me a straight answer, you know?
Yep.
But yeah, that's exactly. Because I didn't know you when, I mean, you came to these conclusions like years ago.
Yeah.
faith crisis and faith transition just a few years ago, right? And mm-hmm. I came to a lot of the same conclusion. It's not like we've had that discussion before and, you know, agreed on it. So
I see that all the time with people just making these discoveries for themselves, you know. Right. Like, oh my gosh, I thought of that too, you know. Like,
yeah. And we come to the same conclusion.
The exact same ones. Exact same ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we're so misled.
It's a matter, I think it's a matter of being willing to look at things with an honest heart and mind and not like, yeah, I mean, undoing what was, you know, done in your brain. And, you know, we were all taught a way to think and whatnot, and coming out of that and then deciding how it is I'm going to think and interpret these things, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I understand being inside and outside because we've done both. So I'm trying to be tolerant and I don't want to muck, you know, people on the inside, and I don't want to call them stupid or whatnot. I get, you know, that also wanting to not move and change things, you know, it's a right, and there is reasons for that. You know, I personally know people who are, they don't believe anymore, but it's not worth it to them to just shake everything up, you know? And that's a choice. And then I don't criticize.
You mean like leave Utah, for instance, or something like that, or what?
Leave the church because they don't believe that their spouse do. And there's no, I mean, and also because they love and value their family or more than the church. I mean, there's also something to be said about people who choose to stay because they love their family, you know,
they love
their spouse, and they would take that suffering. Because for me, honestly, sitting there is torture, and to be able to take that torture every Sunday because you love your, you know, your wife and your children and whatnot, I think it's pretty brave. If I asked you, would you want to go back to church and be active again? What would you say to that?
Never. No.
Okay, so even though it was hard, even
do I understand your question right? Like, now giving everything I know, would I ever go back to church, kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
No.
So no, what I'm interested to know is, you know, kind of the end part of what led to the divorce, and then you're rebuilding of yourself, finding, you know, like your identity, and also with the faith, since, you know, you left it behind. What now is your ground, like your moral ground? How you know, what did you turn to, if anything? Some people become atheist, agnostic, different church. Like, what path did you choose? You know,
I don't like labels, you know, but I guess if I had to categorize myself, it would be like an agnostic atheist, you know.
And how do you define that?
Yeah, so that's why I don't like labels, because it's to me, it's kind of like, that's why the rainbow is such a good symbol of the LGBTQ, you know, Q movement, is because it really is a rainbow. It's a spectrum of beliefs, you know, and it's so personal. Like, and that's one thing I don't like about religion, is like they want to depersonalize beliefs, you know. And but how did I come to that? How would I define it? I think there's nobody I pray to. I don't pray to anyone. Sometimes I do, you know, like out of, you know, if there's anybody out there, come on, I can use some help now, kind of thing, you know. But it's not really taken seriously. Like, I don't take it seriously like I used to. And
like it's religiously, kind of, you've taken the religion out of the
place. Yeah. But as far as like my ground, that is the most wonderful part about this whole faith transition journey. And it was like ironically, it was like a miracle in and of itself. When I was at University of Mississippi, when I was still married, you know, and got divorced, my ex-wife and our toddler son moved back to Texas to live with her brother.
You mean she's still an active member of the church?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She's a very active member of the church. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, she remarried within months after our divorce. Yeah.
Okay. So she's just, you know, deep into that. You're not. So you figure that out. But then that leaves you without anything, because she kept everything she had, basically, as far as like ground and beliefs and whatnot. But you dismantled everything. So
I did. I lost everything at once. Lost my family. You know, I quit graduate school because I was just too depressed to
continue.
Yeah, and that was like my chosen occupation. So I lost that because I had discovered just a few years prior that I wanted to be an evolutionary biologist, and got into a graduate program in that field, and And so it's like, I lost so much at once, you know, and including my beliefs. And
so wait a second, why did you quit graduate school?
I quit graduate school because on the first day of the semester, my fourth semester, that's when I got the divorce letter. She was out of town. She was with her folks and out of state. And so it was just like, it killed me, you know.
And you
they left. They left the first. I did not expect that to happen at all.
Mm-hmm. You were hoping that she would try to understand your situation where you were at. But for her, basically, from what I understand, it's like it was church or nothing.
Exactly.
Church or nothing. Like they would compromise. So she put the church above your family unit, above your union, basically.
Yes, at least in part, because I remember after I got the divorce papers, she kind of went back and forth a little bit, you know, like about as far as what she was going to do. Mm-hmm. She never like fully like withdrew, but like she was kind of on the fence about whether we were going to continue as a couple at some point, you know. But she asked me point blank whether I still really had faith in the church, mm-hmm. or God even. And I said I didn't. And she went and prayed about that, like right then and there on her knees.
Wow.
Came back into the living room later and said that was her answer. She got her answer.
That we needed to be divorced?
That we needed to be divorced, yeah. Wow. There's so much growth from myself has come from the divorce, you know. Like I got talking about fractal recursivity earlier, you know, it's like there's so many things that were bad that happened because I got married and so many good things that happened, you know. And you know, I can say, oh, I never should have got married so young and so naive and all that. But it's like, well, I wouldn't have my son.
You learn from
whatever happens.
Good, good or bad, it's better to have that perspective of, you know, what can I learn from this? How can I grow? Rather than, should never have happened. Yeah, that never leads to anything.
Right, yeah.
What about rebuilding yourself now?
Yeah, so I stopped going to classes, basically. But I still continue teaching because I'm a TA at the time. Mm-hmm. I teach undergraduate biology. I finish out the semester in June, just my teaching responsibilities, and pretty much just like laid in bed and cried myself to sleep every night, mm-hmm. you know, because they had moved, you know, several states away. And I thought that I was doing what was best for them because they didn't have family nearby. And I was just kind of going along with the divorce and honestly feeling like I deserved it. Because there was still this cognitive dissonance about all of this and thinking that I really was a sinner and so forth. You know, one of the things that my ex had said in the letter was that I had been unfaithful to her.
How so?
With the whole internet pornography, you know, internet porn, masturbation stuff, you know, that, you know. And there was one point where, you know, I maybe flirted with somebody online a little bit, but it was almost like an old flame kind of thing. And it wasn't going anywhere. There was no, like, it was just a flirting thing. And she was really upset about that, you know, and kind of used that as if that was one of the reasons. But I think that was more of a smokescreen for the fact that I just didn't believe anymore, you know, or I was losing my belief. I think she as well. And I think a lot of, especially LDS women, deep down, they know that everybody masturbates and looks at porn and stuff, you know, or, you know, that kind of stuff.
You're 100% super naive and you choose to stay in that infant stage, which some are actually. If you listen, I don't know if you listen to my episode 2 of the stages of faith of Fowler's, but like if you're in stage 1 or 2 in your belief, you pretty much like, it's almost like still believing in Santa Claus, where whatever you've been given as a child, as far as like what you should believe as, you know, church and stuff, like you believe literally and you don't expand in your thinking and you don't explore because it's too scary. And
you know,
I remember being there because we're so sheltered and it's bad, 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 you know, and no explanation and no, you know, that we're very immature. I'm talking like adult Mormons, like very immature and very white and very uninformed, misinformed.
Because totally, we're kind of pedomorphic.
Talk about it and see, I mean, did your husband quit working because he wants to lock himself in a room all day and do that?
Right.
Because that's a problem.
That's
a problem. You know?
That's a real problem.
But if not, just talk about it and see what is it it's missing. Maybe he's just bored in the bedroom, you know, like just talk about it. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, one of the first things, and I'm going ahead here a little bit, but right after the divorce, one of the first things my sister was telling me, who's still an active member, was, you know, you should join, it was like LDSsingles.com. Wow. You know, just because, you know, my ex had left and I was like alone, and she thought it would be a good place to just talk to people, you know, and a wholesome place to meet others.
Okay.
And I can't tell you how many profiles I saw where it says, all caps, the very first line, if you look at porn,
yeah,
swipe right. Kind of, yeah, don't talk to me.
You're contaminated, you're leprous.
Exactly, yeah. And you do not see that on dating sites outside of the church.
No, no.
That's a cultural thing. It's not a healthy one.
I had people, I mean, because I also landed, like, you know, after my divorce, like, I was, like, seriously, like, an alien in, like, singles, whatever, dating app. Like, I was, like, a new world. For 1 year, I was like, oh, my goodness, good and bad and everything. But, like, literally, I had people be like, oh, I'm a dominant. Hi, I'm a dominant. What are you? So very comfortable in their skin.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, and it wasn't like a hookup app. Like, I've always been on, like, regular, you know, want to meet a normal person.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. Like, people seem a lot more comfortable with where they're at and their sexuality outside. And since we never talk about it or whatever, like, it's, and you discover it with someone who knows nothing about, if you're going to be a virgin when you get married, both of you are freaking ignorant and you're learning together. And I don't even know how that goes. I mean, I guess I should know because I was there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we were ignorant. And yeah, I don't know. But
yeah, and awkward about it, you know? And like, I noticed that so often still, I still notice that other people are just so much more comfortable in their sexuality, you know, it's like, yeah.
Yep.
And even religious people. So it's like Mormons are just really, really bad at that. I mean,
you said it yourself. we came on top in that research.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Daryl Ray. Yeah.
That's sad. That's really sad.
But, and it's totally predictable that the places and the peoples who obsess about porn are the ones that are most addicted to it, or the subscribe to it the most, you know. Mm-hmm. Because Utah and Mississippi are the two most religious states in the union, and they're also the ones that use the most porn. Yeah.
I thought that was so awesome when that came out. I'm like, see, you've got the problem. So how have you, you know, like, as far as, like, faith goes, like, where are you at right now? Like, and what's your ground? Like, you said you consider yourself agnostic atheist.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, so what it was is I saw in 2012, I had moved in, I left Miss Grad School the first time, and my friend who lives not far from Dallas, but in Oklahoma, asked me if I would come live with him, you know, like, basically just being a friend to me. And he has his own family, and he had his own family at the time and everything. And it was just like, you know, I know this is like a really hard time for you. Why don't you come live with us for a little while, you know? And so quit grad school. I put everything in a moving truck, moved to Oklahoma to be a lot closer to my son and live with my friend for a little bit and his family. And while I was there, I was still so shell-shocked. I hadn't even started to think about, I was still crying myself to sleep every night for a couple of years, missing my kid, you know, but I saw the movie Contact. Mm-hmm. And I was still so shell-shocked. I hadn't even thought, like, about replacing my religion yet, or, you know, replacing my belief system, or, like, whether God is out there or not. I thought about it, of course, but it was still, like, in hindsight, I know I was probably, like, I'm in the back burner, like, still searching, you know, and I saw the movie Contact, which was written by Carl Sagan, you know, and he was easily the most famous science popularizer of the 20th century in the United States, you know, and a scientist and a professor and an astronomer, and worked with NASA on, you know, the Apollo missions, and, you know, and he was this television personality. He's basically like our Neil deGrasse Tyson of, you know, basically around the time that I was born until my mid teenage years. And it was a story written in order to help. His whole purpose was to help people understand what science is. And that's the whole reason that he wrote this story. And it was the most scientifically accurate movie I'd ever seen, you know, because I'm one of those people, if I watch like the movie Anaconda, you know, with J-Lo, you know, of course there's these anaconda snakes that are like 50 feet long and terrorizing everybody, and they can move like 50 miles an hour, you know, and it's like, I'm just sitting there going, no, I'm that kind of person who like scrutinize mm-hmm. the science part of a science fiction movie kind of thing, even though I'm not really like a big science fiction nerd or anything like that. Yeah, I guess I am.
But it's accurate or not.
Yeah. But it was like, it was so compelling. Like, and it, what it did, the story of The Contact, it gave me a compelling scenario that there is life out there probably, you know, that there is probably, if there is any life out there, they've evolved so much because they overcame their more, to use an earthling term, reptilian tendencies, you know, of territoriality and selfishness and greed and all those kinds of things that we tend to associate with the reptilian part of our brain. Mm-hmm. They would have to have overcome that in order to not blow themselves up so that they could, you know, go out and meet these different civilizations and, you know, in the galaxy and so forth. And so it gave me a kind, almost a spiritual ground again, that there's so much that's possible. Everything that's in that movie is essentially possible. And mm-hmm. the guy who, I don't know if you knew this, but the guy who wrote kind of a follow-up to that called Interstellar. Did you see that movie?
I have not. I need to, I need to plug into the sci-fi stuff, but.
Well, he helped Carl Sagan out with some of the science, the wormhole science. And he's a professor. He just won one of the Nobel Prizes in science and physics with the gravitational waves that they detected, you know, at LIGO or whatever. And he actually grew up Mormon in Utah.
Okay.
He's no longer Mormon anymore. His name is Kip Thorne, Professor Kip Thorne.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of stories like that. There are quite a few historian scientists, people who really care about the hard data and the hard, you know, science that have left.
Mm. It's really cool to discover that about him. And it was so accurate. And it was just like, wow, this gives me a whole new perspective, a new paradigm about the universe and how amazing and vast, and that maybe there is some like higher power, what we call a higher power, mm-hmm. or a greater power, a greater knowledge out there than what we have. And there might even be love in the universe, who knows, you know? And so that's what it gave me without having to invoke any kind of supernatural explanations or.
Right. I mean, you just have to look around. I personally think, you know, I'm like you, like, I don't want labels. I call myself spiritual, non-religious. I don't like any ism. I don't want to be in a box, whatever it is, you know, basically like I want to simplify everything. Like I just made a huge effort to like declutter my brain, declutter my mind, like 100%, like, you know, when I did my transition and then started rebuilding. And I want to keep it like so very simple because there's just so much we don't know and open to so many possibilities. But I also don't want to dig too much where it like drives you crazy, because at the end of the day, it's all speculation.
So life is so short.
That too, like, you know, but then just looking around, you know, you look at space, you go, you know, you gaze at the star, it would be so freaking like arrogant to think that we're alone in this whole vast universe, like, and that we're the only thing living or functioning or whatever. Like that alone is just, it's a very silly idea, because I mean, it's just arrogant. It's like human smallness of thinking that, you know, everything revolves around them. And
I don't know
what it is, but I don't believe that we're alone or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Carl Sagan, who wrote that movie, you know, that's at the end of the credits, right before the credits start to roll, it says for Carl, because he died. He was one of the executive producers and he wrote the novel and everything. He died while it was in post-production. And he did get to see it finished, apparently. One of the producers said that in a recent documentary or video, I guess, interview. You know, he was a Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote all these books. And so he was kind of like, gave me that new perspective, you know.
Yeah. And so how does that translate to, you know, like say how you raised your kid, you know, like what do you tell him, what matters? Like, what are the moral foundation? Like, Is it like the golden rule, or like
basically the golden rule and do what is right, you know? And he's such a good kid. Like, I really lucked out, you know?
How do you know what's right if you don't have the Bible or God telling you, or, you know, what's right?
For me personally?
Yeah. I mean, how do you define that?
First, do no harm. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't that what the Hippocratic Oath?
Yeah. Well, but also, but that the Buddhists are pretty much, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. And keep going.
I think become part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, give service to a cause bigger than yourself. You know, I think that's another thing, is to give and to be open-minded, you know. I think that's another part, and to be accepting of others. It's still something I'm struggling with, you know, as far as like having like core teachings of what is right and wrong. I'm very, I don't know if you would call me like a relativist or a moral relativist or something like that. But to me, all of the behaviors that we exhibit as humans is just selfish genes playing themselves out through our behaviors. And but the good thing is that we can methylate those genes. We can, you know, we can change our behaviors. We can change those tendencies we have, and we can boost the ones that that are more beneficial to not only us but to society as well. Right. You know, Carl Sagan, for instance, and his wife Andrean said something like, "We don't want to change propensities. We just want to change the stencils to bring out the best in us, the better angels of our nature."
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
To me, it's always a question, especially for parents leaving a faith or leaving a, you know, what is it I'm going to tell my kids? And I've said that before in other discussions, but to me, it's very important that they learn to think for themselves. You also do no harm. You know, that's, I think, the basic gold, call it the golden rule, or do no harm. Or, you know, I think we do need to listen to that thing called conscience. Like, you know, if you get those bad feelings or you have these, I believe in, you know, your gut feeling, your intuition, which is usually trying to lead you the right way. Just like animals have this defensive mechanism, or they're like apprehensive or whatnot. As, you know, as humans, you know, some form of animal, whatever, we have that. And I think the more we are connected to ourselves, you know, others, and the more we can pay attention to that and love. I mean, whatever that means for whoever, but I think that's definitely a universal concept, that if you kind of focus on that, everything that seeps out that mind frame leads to something good or better, because you don't hurt someone out of love. I mean, sometimes you do, but that's because of, you know, misconception. And I also don't believe that we can love everyone. Like, I don't believe that we can tolerate and be respectful to everyone. That shouldn't be hard to really, truly love. I think it takes work. We're just humans. I'm more of a show me, you know, rather than tell me. If they show me and show me how do you love, you know, because you just say, but, you know, I don't buy that so much. And that's why, you know, big preaching on the pulpit and whatnot, like, I just get tired with that. I'm like, just show it. Don't say anything and show it.
Yeah. I try not to have like an article of faith or whatever, but I if I had one, it would probably be the Pale Blue Dot soliloquy by Carl, you know, Carl Sagan. Not to keep, like, you know, be such fanboy, you know, but like, he was sort of like what started me having this other sense of spirituality, you know, as far as the universe and everything. And but, you know, it's basically, are you familiar with that?
Not
with
really
the Pale Blue Dot, that he the very first image of Earth that was taken as a tiny dot in the sky and not like a big globe from, say, from the Apollo missions on the moon, you know, happened in 1990, and it was because of Carl Sagan, which is, I think, it makes him so much more fascinating. But it happened on Valentine's Day in 1990, and a lot of the astronomers at NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab and all that other stuff, right, they didn't want to use the scientific instruments to turn the camera back towards Earth at this crucial moment just to take a picture of Earth. It wasn't useful scientifically. There was no science in that. But Carl wanted us to see ourselves as a little point in the sky and see how fragile we are, you know? And like, and so there's a part of his book called The Pale Blue Dot. And it's an excerpt out of that that's just known as The Pale Blue Dot, like soliloquy, I guess you could call it. Mm-hmm. And it just talks about our perspective, you know, like every human who ever lived, every sinner, every saint, every, you know, superstar, every tyrant, you know, every small child, every young couple in love, you know, has lived here on this little point of sky, point of pale blue light, you know, in the sky, you know, on this little dot. And so how silly is it to think about our wars and our contentions and all the things that we fight over, you know, to fight over a little piece of pixel, you know?
That little point in the universe that's really insignificant.
Yeah. It's like, it's what he called, like, he called those, like, the chauvinisms, you know, and the basically removing ourselves from being the at the center of everything. The great demotions is what he called them. And so I think that provides my kind of article of faith of
just keeping it all in perspective.
And, you know, my favorite song, if I had to pick a song that was like the anthem of my ethics and so forth, is probably Imagine by John Lennon.
Absolutely. I like that. Yeah. That's a beautiful way to end this conversation, which we're going to probably pick up again, because I'm going to ask you to come again, because you know there's some other stuff we need to talk about.
Definitely.
Just to let the audience know, you know, we have had some conversation about weed and stuff, and so we'll have one just on that. But I love your perspective. I'm happy that you've kind of found your ground, at least, you know, as far as faith goes. We can bring up some other points, maybe some things that you would have liked to share, but, you know, for the sake of time, we can't today. So, but thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I know it's going to be helpful for many people going through this or having this same kind of realization. I think it's good to share, and you've accomplished a lot, and, you know, things are going to be great. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Remember that life has amazing things in store for you if you don't give up. I'm Juliana. This is the Faith Transition Podcast. I will see you next time.